much for joining us today. This is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, and as always, wishing you the best. We would love you to go ahead and join our community. And all you have to do is go to naturalnurse.com. That's all one word. And once you get there, if you go to the lower left-hand corner on the front page, you can just sign up. All we need is your email, nothing else. And then we will send you a very occasional newsletter. I would say once a month or less. We don't inundate people with emails. But another way to stay in touch is just go to naturalnurse.com and go to calendar. When you go to calendar, you'll see several of the up and coming classes that we are doing. And of course, nowadays we have many of them online. Two that we have listed there right now, one is called Scientific Validation of Herbal Medicine. And this offers three CEUs for massage therapists, dietitians, nurses, and midwives. And you also get tons of information about the scientific validation of botanical medicine. So we're taking signups for that right now. I believe there is a reduced rate. And then next month we have one on thyroid, adrenal, and pituitary, the sacred trione, herbal balance. But the scientific validation is about the fact that very often people will hear something from their physicians, and we're going to bring on a physician today who won't tell us that, I don't think, saying that all natural medicine and all herbal medicine has no history of use and has not been specifically studied for particular actions. And what we're going to do in this class, Scientific Validation of Herbal Medicine, is actually investigate all the scientific data, not all of it, because that would take years, but we are to look up all the scientific validation of herbal medicine that exists in mainstream medical literature, not just in Herbalgram magazine, but in mainstream medical literature. So if you'd like to take that and also talk about the scientific validation, and if you want CEU credits, if you don't want CEU credits, you don't have to get them. So just go to naturalnurse.com calendar to see the classes. Today, we're so happy to have on board as our guest, Dr. Kenneth Redcross, who is an MD with that profound name. He was born with that name. Are you kidding, Dr. Redcross? You had no choice.
No, it shows you the good Lord has a sense of humor. That's for sure.
I know. It's like, oh, I don't want to do that. Too bad. You know, it's on your monocle already. And he is the author of Bond, The Four Cornerstones of a Lasting and Caring Relationship with Your Doctor. And Dr. Redcross runs his own concierge personalized medical practice designed to enhance the patient-doctor relationship while providing convenient access to a full spectrum of healthcare services and holistic and wellness counseling. And today, we're going to focus on why COVID-19 might be affecting more people of color and specific communities more than other populations. But also, we'll talk about his philosophy in general, and we'll delve into vitamin D, which he has a very deep understanding of. So thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Redcross.
Oh, thank you, Ellen. Thanks for having me on. Good morning, everyone.
Now, we have you all the way till around 11, so we're not in a rush. Well, sometimes it's a five-minute soundbite.
Sure.
I'd like you, again, because your name is Redcross, but what else made you become a physician as your life's work?
You know, guys, it's interesting. You know, my last name, Redcross, has an interesting kind of background. It's a Native American background. The first Redcrosses actually were down south, and one was John Redcross, who was actually Native American. So, as a kid, I remembered things that were very spiritual to me, whether it be going to a powwow. But for me, it was always about the person and the spirit of the person, not necessarily so much on the religion side of things, Ellen, but literally the spirituality of being. And so I always had an affinity for people, and then later for patients. And so it's something that's really defined who I am, if you will. So I always knew that I wanted to do be a part of a service that was giving back and hoping and improving lives each and every day.
That's wonderful. So really following what we call in, you know, Eastern mystical tradition, there's something called Dharma.
Yeah, yeah.
And you might be familiar with it.
Oh, yeah, so, very.
So share with us, what is your understanding of Dharma?
Look, for me, my Dharma, and I'm a meditator. I do my best because, as you've already pointed out, I'm pretty busy. I'm always on the go. But for me, I mean, every day that I live is really about purpose, to be quite honest with you, Ellen. I try to, at the end of the day, try to tell myself, what have I learned today? What have I brought to the world? And it's a fascinating exercise if you can really sit down and see, even if your day was a little tough, sometimes you can kind of look back and say, you know what? I learned a lot and I really made a difference in someone's life. And that for me kind of brings everything back full circle.
Yes, it does, because you're doing, when people are doing their life's work, as I feel I am as well,
yeah,
you know, it's so exciting. And when I started in this field of natural medicine in 1964, it was definitely not the in thing. No. So I didn't say, oh, let me do something that's really popular and really great in terms of making money, let's say.
Right.
It was just my path and my interest. And of course, then I got regular degrees both in teaching and nursing. Mm-hmm. So I taught science. But when I was teaching science at a university in Arizona, what I brought into the curriculum with my group of students, who, by the way, were mostly Mexican at that mm-hmm. point, because mm-hmm. it's in southern Arizona. So oh. I brought into my science curriculum, here's an assignment. Go home and ask your grandmother what plant she uses for little things like coughs and colds and flus.
Wow.
Here, I was doing research that satisfied me. I was honoring the tradition of my students, and that can definitely be within science, because then I made them look up the genus and species and the mechanisms
right.
of action. And, you know, so you can bring your joy into your work very often, sometimes in sneaky ways.
Exactly. You know, it's funny. My path was very similar in the sense that I also worked with underprivileged populations for years. I started as a student working in the rainforest in El Junque in Puerto Rico. And then after I finished my training here in New York at Columbia, I went out to California, kind of close to Arizona. And I went out to California and I worked for 4 years with migrant Mexican farm workers in the strawberry fields.
Oh, what area? What area?
Yeah, I was in Oxnard. I was in Oxnard in California. I was mentioning California was close to Arizona, but I was in Oxnard near San Diego.
So that was more in the northern end.
Exactly.
So wonderful. I was actually in southern Arizona, in Bisbee, Arizona, which is on the Mexican border. I mean, you can see Mexico. That's where we went food shopping. It was just right across the street, literally. But and it was a lot less expensive there and just walk back with the groceries. But those are the old days.
Exactly. The old days, the good old days, as they call them. But a lot like you, working with underserved populations, really, it really helped mold me. And you're right, as you said at the top of your show, I'm not one of those docs who, even though I'm Western trained, is going to come and say there's no role for natural medicine, because that just wouldn't be true, or herbals and that sort of thing. And so all of those experiences really kind of helped mold who I am today. A lot like you, you were a pioneer. I mean, in my time, it wasn't so much about the patient-doctor experience, right? It was all about the doctor seeing the patients and seeing as many patients as you want. So I was a little bit of an outlier and said, well, what about the happiness for the patient? What about their experience versus the financial bottom line? And so I was a little bit of a maverick when I started my career as well, like you.
But excuse me, Dr. Red Cross, what about the happiness of the physician? How many of your colleagues feel really satisfied to walk into a room and they have exactly 7 or 8 minutes?
Yeah, yeah.
And most of the time, they don't even get to get over near the patient where they could touch them or smell them. They are in the corner at the computer monitor, looking up the code, which they don't know, and they curse under their breath because they can't find it, and that's the visit. And then they scribble a prescription, and who knows what? I mean, that's not satisfying for them either, I'm sure.
No, it isn't, and it's a really big problem, which is something I realized, thank God, earlier in my career to say there has to be a better way for my happiness. And once again, I put everything back on the happiness for the patient, because when you provide happiness for the patient, that usually makes most physicians happy, or anyone, or nursing as well. Any of us in our field, we went into this field because we love and adore people, and we obviously love and we want to bring health to them as well. And no, you can't do that in the 7.5 minutes that you're supposed to get. And so that's why I left a practice that was based more on volume and created my own practice that was based more on value.
Well, and it wound up to be an excellent thing.
Yeah, it did.
Now, were you early on, before our COVID involvement, which of course we're going to talk about today,
sure.
Were you offering something like telemedicine already?
You know, not in the same way at all. You know, it's interesting. My practice has always been kind of, as I like to say, it's kind of high tech, high touch. So what I was doing is I was already making house calls. So that didn't really change much with COVID. In fact, COVID allowed me to make even more house calls because people were not going to the hospital. They were terrified to go to the hospital. So before COVID, not so much telemedicine for me, but a lot of house calls and, once again, high touch.
Really? What I'm enjoying about the availability of telemedicine for patients, I actually think it's a great thing. And I think, you know, everything, no matter how negative it appears, there's always a polarity. So while so many things about COVID is horrible, which we'll discuss, you know, I feel one of the positive outcomes about it actually has been an increase in telemedicine because, you know, that gives people flexibility, another choice, and then they don't have to necessarily leave their home. But especially with the FaceTime, you could do a lot. Like as a physician, I'm sure you could look at a rash, you know, even that way, especially with a client you know already well.
Sure.
And see if it's something that requires that house call by you or if you could help them at a distance. So it just gives more options.
No, it does. And as you see, it's growing like crazy with all of the you know, the companies that are out there. And we'll talk about that as far as access as well, which we'll circle back to. But that's an important part of which telemedicine can help with.
It's so true. Now, what are some of the problems going on now? You know, COVID, every day we're getting different and confusing information, Dr. Red Cross. And as a medical doctor, I'm so happy we have you here to ask you. Now, of course, your opinion, although it's a learned opinion, still can only be based on the data you have today. Right. And it seems like it's changing tomorrow.
Yeah.
Like recent reports have come out about the fact that maybe if you had an infection already, that doesn't mean you don't get it again.
Yeah.
So how do you feel about that?
You know, it's interesting, Ellen, because you're right. It's a moving target. So it's hard for us in the medical community. So I can only imagine how much confusion is out there amongst patients as well. Look, I think one of the important things is for us to all circle around and realize the most important things that we can do. It's hand washing, it's making sure to wear a mask and distance. That's something that no matter what, Ellen, that doesn't change. Even as we get more and more information and more data, you know, are antibodies helpful? Does that confer immunity? All of those battles are going to rage on as we get more and more data. But those three things, whether it be a mask, hand washing, and social distancing, that's something that at least doesn't change. And so I try to get my patients, for all of us, to at least hang on to that, especially with the flu season coming pretty soon also.
Oh, my God. What a complication that's going to be.
Well,
don't you think, you know, with everybody who are participating in those very simple things that you just mentioned, hand washing, wearing a mask, and social distancing, won't that also be protective against any flu, even if it's not a COVID virus?
Well, that's the thing. That's why I say my fingers are crossed. Back to what you were saying, it's like there's always a silver lining. The way I see it, I never see the glass half empty. It's always half full. And this is a perfect example of that, because everyone really sit back and think, when is the last time, what flu season do you remember when we're talking about masks, when we're really, really going hard in hand washing, and especially social distancing? So the hope with that is that even as the flu virus comes in a few short weeks, that we're prepared for it. And I would love to see some really, really low numbers, especially in the beginning, because once again, I don't think we've ever been this prepared for a flu virus, or I should say a virus in general that we know is coming no matter what. So you're right. The hope is that this is a positive thing. On the flip side, we just want to make sure we're utilizing these measures, because we do not want to have a bunch of cases of flu and COVID kind of vacillating back and forth between each other. So we want to make sure that we're on top of it from the beginning.
Now, in terms of vaccinations, Dr. Red Cross, I'd like to discuss your opinion about those. In particular, from my data, and perhaps I'm wrong, but I haven't seen that the flu vaccination has been that tremendously effective at avoiding flu, since the flu also mutates year to year, and by the time the vaccine catches up, it's several years ago.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting there. And this is a super tough topic, right? Because like I mentioned before, I'm Western trained, open to Eastern ideals, and understand the parts of healing and how I have some patients who are anti-vaccine and some who live by the vaccine. I'll tell you this, lots of times I'm in the middle. And when I say in the middle, for instance, the year that we had the H1N1, which was 2009, the flu vaccine was horrid. It was terrible. And so therefore, it wasn't something I was necessarily recommending. But a couple of years ago, you guys may remember, last season and the one before, there were so many children that were dying from the flu. And the studies were bearing out, while the vaccine was not perfect, a little under 30% of efficacy, we do know that it was helpful at that time for children, to help children prevent the obviously the horrible complication of death and any morbidity associated with that. So I really assess each and every year, Ellen, so it is not always just a knee-jerk reaction. But to your point, even a good flu vaccine, we try to get closer to 30%. But once again, it's one of those things when you're trying to protect the children and the elderly. So it just kind of depends on how good a job we do at figuring out what strains are kind of coming our way. That's the big thing that's really most important, I think.
So it sounds like you don't have this super strong, which we're hearing from most physicians, everybody should always get a flu shot all the time, and it's really going to really, really effectively protect you.
Well, look, like I said, it really depends on the year. It really truly does, because that H1N1 year was a big wake-up call for a lot of us to say, gosh, guys, I don't think this is a good vaccine for us to have. And to complicate things further, we're obviously trying to wait and hear a little bit more about this coronavirus vaccine that, you know, may be coming sooner than later. I don't think it's going to come as soon as some of the news is saying. But, you know, when we're talking about the skepticism that we have here in the United States, it's a big problem, because they're having a hard time, for instance, getting minorities to trust the process in particular, and that is kind of being rushed through. So that's not going to help vaccine health or those who are behind vaccines to get a collective behind a strong message as to what we're looking for success wise if you're going to get the vaccine.
Okay, I'll let you off the hook with the vaccine discussion.
So you're
saying, and then of course for me, I'll just chime in.
Sure.
I'm not a big proponent of vaccines, I have to say, for many reasons. My own children, my older son, I want to send a shout out to him. God bless you, Titus Comet Kohutek. Today's his 45th birthday.
Oh, nice. Happy birthday to him.
45, and he is a spectacular being. And so he was never vaccinated as a child, because that's how long my beliefs about that have been in place. I'll just share for many reasons. You know, on the other hand, it's fine if people do want to do it. I'm only interested in the right to choose. That's my big deal. So there's some fear involved with the up-and-coming COVID vaccine because it seems like they're going to make it mandatory for everybody. In terms of childhood vaccines here in New York, although not true all over the country, you're not going to school without that childhood vaccine. And I know many people who have either A, moved out of New York, or B, moved to homeschooling because of that. Wow. So, you know, just in terms of personal choice issues. But anyway, we'll go on to a different topic from there. Now, let's talk about COVID. What is different about this infection versus something like flu? Because it seems like it's almost a political discussion where they're saying, oh, it's the same as the flu. What's your learned opinion?
So everyone, let's think about this, right? And honestly, it doesn't matter which side of the aisle that anyone's on that's listening now. It is not a political discussion, actually. It's a public health discussion, okay? As I always tell a lot of my patients, because I'm right in the middle, I have patients on either side of the aisle, and the most important thing is that we stay healthy and get through this thing, and then we can live to fight another day on political issues. Now, when we're looking at this, everyone, so the coronavirus, or COVID-19 as we're calling this one, let's also remember, the coronavirus is not new to us. It's the fact that this is a new strain of the coronavirus, a kind of mutated one in a sense. So that's why that's what's giving us so many headaches, guys. Our immune system hasn't seen it before. Now, the flu virus is influenza. It's a totally different virus. The only thing that they share is that, yes, they're both viruses. And they both, you know, require, well, one has a vaccine and one we're trying to get. But the point is that they're different, but they're also come back again to be the same in that they are respiratory viruses. Hence, I get back to the importance of that mask and the distancing, that once again, it's not political. It's just public health and kind of common sense that if it's a respiratory virus, you want to keep it from getting droplets or aerosolizing on someone else. That's all. Not political at all, but that's the difference in the coronavirus and influenza. They're totally different viruses, and the only thing they share is that they're both respiratory viruses, and they both also can, just like any other opportunistic infection, prey on those who are especially young and those who are a little bit older as well.
Well, that's another important point to talk about, and I'd like to remind our listeners, you are listening to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, right here on Progressive Radio Network, where we bring you this show every Tuesday, 10 to 11 a.m. But in addition, here on PRN, you can find all of our shows archived as well. So, Dr. Redcross, it definitely is true, now that we're well into this COVID-19, hundreds of thousands of people. This is amazing. I mean, it's just a huge, it seems like, infection across the country.
Yeah.
So we're starting to see some, you know, reliable data about groups of people that are more affected than others. And it definitely seems, from the data I'm reviewing, that low-income communities are more highly impacted. Would you say it's racial or income that's the bigger link to having a more severe reaction when you do get infected?
I'd actually say, Ellen, it's actually both, and they typically go hand in hand here in the United States as far as the what you're seeing in the data. Look, in the data, you're seeing that African Americans are by far most affected, almost six times the mortality of non-African Americans or minority, with Hispanics close second, maybe about 10 percentage points a little bit lower. So you're seeing in these communities where social distancing is close to impossible, you're seeing these differences that are happening as far as how the population is actually dealing with some of the what's going on at COVID-19, which isn't really slowing down so much in that population.
So that's interesting. I wonder if there's been a study, let's say, of low income areas that are not necessarily racially divided. You know, there are areas around the country, rural areas, that are very, very low income as well. But the difference is they're usually not as packed with people from a density perspective.
Right. And what you're saying there in middle America isn't necessarily based as much, to your point, on ethnicity as it is to access and utilization. doing, you know, being so spread out and that sort of thing in middle America, it's a little different because they don't have the per capita of physicians and care and that sort of thing. So utilization is different. And that's exactly what the data is showing now. You're starting to see that there in the kind of the breadbasket or around those areas, you're starting to see an increase of issues as far as with COVID-19. But in the minority community, you know, the thing that's interesting is that there are some things that can really probably make a really big difference. And that's the whole point for me to hit the airwaves and get out there and talk about that. You mentioned we're going to talk about vitamin D at some point in the show, but, you know, that's something that I'm really feeling can be special to really make a difference in a lot of people's lives, especially some of people who are minorities or underserved.
So that is an important point. So what are some of those things that you, you know what, it's right break time. It's right at break time, Dr. Ken okay. Red Cross. So okay. We are speaking today with Dr. Red Cross. You can find him at drkenredcross.com. Fascinating physician who offers concierge care. And we're going to take a little break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And when we come back, we will continue our discussion with Dr. Ken Red Cross.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the ancient Chinese science and art of acupuncture.
Acupuncture is a 5,000-year-old medical procedure involving insertion and manipulation of needles into specific points on the body. It is often applied to relieve pain during surgery and for many other conditions.
Acupuncture needles have been found in China that are over 4,000 years old. The first needles were made of stone. Later, bronze, gold, or silver was used, and today they are usually made from steel. Acupuncture was developed around the theory of special meridian points on the body connected to the internal organs, and that vital energy, or qi, flows along these meridians. According to this theory, diseases are caused by interrupted energy flow, and the stimulation of these points restores normal energy circulation. There is some scientific evidence of the existence of the meridians as a separate circulatory system. Studies were done in the 1970s by a Dr. Kim from Korea, where he injected radioactive dyes into the traditional acupuncture points. He observed migration of the dyes along the exact predicted path of the meridians.
Okay. How acupuncture works remains uncertain, but both Western and Eastern scientific studies on rabbits have shown that the analgesic effects are not simply a matter of suggestion. After the discovery in 1975 of endorphins, natural pain inhibitors in the body, some neurophysiologists suggested that the needles may trigger the release of these substances. American and Chinese studies have confirmed that placing acupuncture needles in the brains of dogs raises the level of endorphins in the spinal fluid.
Acupuncture is used today in most hospitals in China and by many private practitioners in virtually every country in the world, including the United States. The primary use is for analgesia, although ulcers, hypertension, asthma, and other conditions have been documented to respond favorably to this treatment. Chinese surgeons prefer acupuncture to the use of drug-induced analgesia because they claim it does not disturb normal body physiology and therefore does not make the patient vulnerable to shock. Brain surgery is especially amenable to this form of analgesia when it is necessary to keep the patient awake during the operation.
Although some modifications in the practice of acupuncture have been made, such as sometimes using a small electric current on the needle instead of the traditional twirling, acupuncture remains intact as an ancient therapeutic technique that has been used successfully for at least 5,000 years. Perhaps you'd like to add this piece of knowledge to your natural medicine chest.
Welcome back. Thank you so much for joining us right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we're here with our wonderful guest today, knowledgeable guest, Dr. Kenneth Red Cross, medical doctor, and he's been using the word, he's in between. So he would say, you know, he has a moderate viewpoint where he is balancing all the things he knows as a conventionally trained medical doctor, and then also his perspective of a more holistic patient-doctor relationship than we usually see, so that he has room to understand different people's wants and needs. And that's how he based his concierge practice. And so what we're talking about now in terms of COVID-19, what happens with people's perception and also with the rate of infection and how ill people really get? Because an awful lot of people, actually, it seems like most people who even do test positive either never knew they were ill or had minor or no symptoms. And yet many die.
Yeah, I know. And that's the hard part. Now, you know, it's interesting. I was on a trip. I drove out to Cape Cod and I met with a family there. We were right there at the poolside. And the husband found out I was a physician, overheard me, and he asked me, you know, I was talking with a group of my friends and they said that the flu is much worse as far as deaths in COVID-19. And so it was a fascinating discussion because that gets back to what you're talking about, Ellen, that perception. Because I'll tell everyone here, that's actually not true. And the fact that the percentage as far as of death with COVID is actually higher than that of the flu, which is almost less than 1% or so. So the point is, that's that perception piece that we're starting to hear as far as COVID versus the flu. And they're always going to kind of go head to head when people are, you know, having friends and so forth that are doing well after getting COVID. But it's something that we still need to take seriously because of what we know it's able to do, especially to the elderly. I've seen even some patients, a friend of mine, 40 years old, was actually hospitalized and placed on a ventilator and luckily is now extubated, meaning off the ventilator, everyone, but he's 40-something years old. And there's so many stories like that when you hear about COVID.
Yeah, so it's like nobody knows how they are going to react, it seems.
Right.
But now I know there is a story, and also in terms of the communities we talked about, in terms of Black and brown communities having higher, more severe effect rates. And is it a higher death rate as well?
It actually is. And there's a few things that we should learn along the way, everyone. So, you know, one of the big important things for me today as I come on is to really challenge all of you. We're going to talk a little bit about vitamin D, but I want to challenge all of you to, number one, get your levels checked. And then I want to make sure that when the levels are checked, Ellen, that everyone's between 40 and 60. That's kind of the sweet spot. Now, why does that matter now as we're talking about how minorities are affected with the coronavirus? Well, number one, let's look at the medical diseases that are associated most with COVID-19. Number one, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, lung disease, and obesity. All four of which are pretty rampant in the African American and also the Latino population as well. Those are the ones, the disease states that COVID has really been preying on. Then the second thing, what about the socioeconomic issues, Ellen? Well, the healthcare access, the fact that there's income inequality, the fact that there's housing issues in underserved areas. And so all of those things have really come together to create a perfect storm because those disease states are also all associated with low vitamin D levels as well. And number one in the United States, as far as lowest vitamin D levels, 82% African Americans again. So that's how we're learning and understanding that, you know, vitamin D may play an important role here, Ellen, because it's so, so important for all of our immune systems, whether you're a minority or not.
So vitamin D levels are important. And I know that you have a place that people can actually get vitamin D tested on their own because sometimes health insurance does not even cover vitamin D testing. I don't know.
Yeah, me either. Well, that's another discussion for another day of why that should be so difficult when it shouldn't. But you're right. Look, it used to be easy pre-COVID. Go into your doctor's office, go get your vitamin D level. But now there's a website, everyone. It's called thepowerofd.org. And the reason why I mentioned thepowerofd.org is not only, as Ellen says, you can order an at-home test kit. So in the comforts of your home, you can order that kit, get it sent home. It's a finger stick, everyone. You stick your finger put a couple of drops of blood, and you send it back to them. And usually within a week or so, you'll get your results, if not a little bit sooner. Now, at thepowerofd.org, they also have an ability for you to calculate how much vitamin D you should take based on the levels that you receive back, along with a myriad of other information. So these are the sort of the educational vehicles that I think are so important for us to all understand that something as simple as vitamin D, which everyone really isn't the vitamin. Vitamin D is really a pro-hormone. But the point for our discussion today is we do know vitamin D's importance in the immune system. And while a lot of the black and brown communities are dealing with it, at least everyone out there listening can understand, like, oh, I didn't recognize that some of those challenges existed for them, which is the reason why we keep learning so much in the news about these populations and mortality and morbidity.
So, you know, now let's talk more about the comorbidities, because those comorbidities they're talking about, let's list some of what those are.
Well, you know, it depends. You know, some of those things that are kind of left behind. I mean, I have some patients who have gotten over COVID and they feel like their cognition is not the same. Have some patients who are positive and feel like they have shortness of breath and fatigue. And then there's mental anguish that kind of comes along with it as well. So these are some of the things that people are like, you know, I get the coronavirus, it's not a big deal. Well, guys, sometimes there's things that are left behind that we're learning more and more about. Don't forget, we haven't turned the page on this yet. So to your point earlier, Ellen, we're still learning more almost daily about the coronavirus and the sort of things that it can kind of leave behind, especially after some of the end organ damage that it causes. You know, that's another point when we talk about vitamin D is important. Vitamin D can be important, everyone, in something that can be called a cytokine storm. That's a big, big word just to mean our immune system can kind of go a little haywire when it sees the coronavirus. And when it goes haywire, it damages a lot of other organs, whether it be your kidneys, whether it be the brain in the form of a stroke, or whether it be some of your extremities because of thrombi or blood clot. So that vitamin D actually can help potentially regulate that portion of the immune system as well. So, you know, as we talk about this, and I mentioned thepowerofd.org, and I really implore everyone, just get your levels checked. You'll understand why I say that and why it's so, so important.
So now also, what about paying attention to your overall health? I think this is a really good example, because if you're looking at people that normally in a population have a higher amount of certain comorbidities, such as high blood pressure and overweight, what are some of the other ones that, you know, sort of lend you to become sicker if you do get sick? That's in general.
Yeah, lots of times it's those things that you mentioned, because, you know, blood pressure can sometimes be silent, even lung disease, even modifiable behaviors. Believe it or not, smoking was, it makes sense, but smoking was absolutely horrible with those patients who contracted the COVID-19 or the coronavirus. Once again, it's an immune system issue, and comorbidities are always a setup for things to go wrong should we kind of get exposed to something like a virus. And actually, that's the same in this case, Ellen, for influenza as well. Same sort of thing, very opportunistic. And so when you have any sort of comorbid illnesses, like you mentioned, like hypertension or COPD or an active chronic smoker, those are things that we need to get on top of to really make sure we ensure health going forward.
And, you know, so also it seems like these comorbidity things that you just mentioned, Dr. Redcross, when we talk about something like obesity, high blood pressure, smoking, other lung problems, which are often linked to things you can't control, such as air pollution.
Yeah.
But it's often linked also to who's smoking cigarettes in the house.
Yeah.
I mean, how much of the illnesses linked to these things are genetic versus what you do?
Oh, God, that's a great question there, because actually it's a little bit of each. You can kind of cherry pick from each one, because there's a gene pool that we all have, of course. And then there are some modifiable behaviors, we call them, where, you know, for some of us in our bodies, you know, you have somebody that smokes 40 years and they're fine, and someone who's just been smoking 10 years and they're COPD and they need a lung transplant. So, yeah, there are some things that we do to ourselves that are modifiable behaviors in addition, that when added to comorbid illnesses are just a setup for a disaster.
So what are some of those factors that someone can change within their own life?
Well, you know, one of the big things, and you touched upon it, we mentioned it a couple of times, is obesity, everyone. So obesity is something else that is incredibly important in the brown and black community. I mean, all around the United States, of course, but especially. Some studies will say that 4 in 5 African-American women are considered to be overweight or obese. So everyone says, okay, doc, being overweight, I understand there's some cosmetic issues you may not like about that, but why does it matter? Well, it also matters in that obesity can lead to issues to create diabetes because of glucose insensitivity. Obesity can also lead to cardiovascular disease and to CHF or congestive heart failure. So when you think of these things, obesity almost it lives on its own, Ellen, a bit, but then it can complicate and create the other things that are on the list also. And it's something that we can control. We can control by obviously what we put in our mouths. And then we need to do something else, which we have not been doing really well as Americans, is exercise. Exercise, you know, I always love when people, my patients will say, well, doc, you don't understand. I exercise at work. I run really, really far. All I'm doing is going up and down stairs. But that's baseline stuff, Ellen. Exercise is when you're unable to speak in full sentences. That's true exercise there.
Oh, so you're talking about that the aerobic portion has to be included.
It does. It does. And look, even if you're lifting weights and you're doing more anaerobic, it's fine. But do that with a pace as well. But that needs to be exercise. You have to burn calories. Your body is a machine. So you have to burn more off than you're taking in. Luckily, that's pretty simple. But then there is an education piece around that as well. And I understand that. And that's something else that needs to be better fleshed out and to get that into the communities.
Well, it's so important because you know what? Not only do you look better, but you feel better.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, what about the fact that people say, oh, I live in a food desert, so yeah, I can't eat healthy. What do you think of that?
And Ellen, that's kind of my newer thing I'm trying to think about, guys, as I'm, you know, as I'm making house calls and going to places, and sometimes I may be in areas that are a little more underserved. And that's really tough for me because I had a practice that I ran in Harlem, and it was fortunate in that Harlem got a lot of acclaim for being a city that's going through a little bit of gentrification and opening up.
A little bit? Wait a minute. A little bit? You can find juice bars all over there and all organic everything nowadays.
Yeah, that's true. But the juice bars weren't there when I first started.
Right.
So that's 100% true. But I'll tell you, you know, and they were able to do it with a lot of collectives and initiatives and that sort of thing. So now in that community, you're right. It's beautiful to see these fresh fruits and vegetables offered to these people who were underserved before. And so I am trying to literally, as this day, figure out how to kind of make a blanket sort of program that, to your point, can get into those communities to give them healthy alternatives. And then there's an education piece as to that why they're healthy and why you should do them and what you should stamp out. I always joke around with all my patients and say, I want you to avoid two things. I want you to avoid anything that leaves powder on your fingers. And the second thing I want you to make sure to avoid is anything that ends in O's, such as the something O's and the that of O's. I don't want to mention any brands, but the point is those things are usually your snack foods that are leaving powder and have O's at the end, and they're never...
Wait. What are you talking about? I never heard this before. They have an O at the end of their name? Like
O's. Like, we'll say this to not put down any brands in that way, but for instance, things that leave powder. Let's just say in this case, powdered donuts.
Okay.
There's also snack foods, whether they be some of the chip brands that may have O's at the end, that sort of thing.
Okay.
They usually aren't good for you, especially someone who's already obese and not necessarily taking care of themselves. And, you know, I'll say it this way. So even my kids, I have twins, and I had to even take a bag of Doritos away.
Okay.
My son. All right. Nothing wrong. Look, guys, I'm just talking in general. Okay. But in any case, I'm like, what are you doing? You can't bring that in here. Once again, it does two things. There's O's at the end when you say it, and there's powder on the fingers. The point is, that's not a good whole food that I'd like my son to be eating. And so those are the things that we need to be more mindful about what we're putting into our bodies. And that's all I want to do. I want to bring that to communities, to be mindful about what we're putting in our bodies.
how I dealt with that with my kids, which I shared with you earlier, went turning 45 today. So God bless you, Titus Kamakahutek. And how I dealt with that, which is challenging as a parent, was that those things were never in my house.
Yeah.
But I did not put a law down about forbidding it at a friend's house or elsewhere or a party, because this is what I found. Although I would have preferred to forbid it totally, the child is going to eat them then. And then he has the bad food and lying, yeah, you know, which is almost worse than just the bad food. So yeah, that was just a parenting tip that I used, which actually worked out in an interesting way. My son really chooses to live very healthy lifestyle, and while my other child does not necessarily do that. So, you know, they're all their own people.
They are. They are. And, you know, another common offender, too, Ellen, is soda. Soda's
big,
a big no.
Big,
yeah, that's, yeah,
big.
Exactly. Mega. And so luckily, you know, I don't really have those battles or any of that sort of thing with my kids. They get that part. And like I said, I don't even think my son understood that snack was not a good one at the time. But the point is, soda's a big offender, especially in the community. Well, we get back to that. Remember I mentioned, guys, a few minutes ago about obesity and how obesity can lead to glucose resistance or insulin resistance. Well, that's one of the things that soda does, everyone. I mean, soda is something, number one, it's obviously not a whole food. It's 100% artificial. And it's one of those things can raise your glucose levels, which is something we don't want, and increase insulin resistance. So when I keep saying insulin resistance, everyone, what I mean is that you have insulin circulating in your body. And we know that insulin drives sugar into the cells so that we can use them for energy, right? But what happens with insulin resistance is that it's circulating, but because of obesity and other factors, guess what? Your body doesn't recognize it. So therefore, that sugar is rotating in your body all day long, or circulating all day long, and it does big, big problems, whether it be to your heart, to your brain, to the back of your eyes, for those who are diabetics, for the blood vessels in the toes as well. So soda is something that if you could stop today, there's a few take-homes today. Number one, make sure to get your vitamin D level checked and make sure it's between 40 and 60. And you go to powerofd.org. The last one, or the second one, it's a big, big one as well, is no more sodas. If you can avoid it, everyone, no more sodas. The good thing is there are some natural alternatives that are over the counter, Ellen, that are said to be a little bit better. I can't say I vetted any of them, but if you need that carbonation, there's a lot of ways to do it naturally and in a healthy way.
Great advice. We're going to take another little break right here, Dr. Red Cross,
sure,
for our station identification here for Progressive Radio Network, so people know all the wonderful information. And then we'll come back for our wrap-up session. Thank you so much, listeners, for joining us. We'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
5G? Where is 5G? 5G is something you cannot see, but 5G will be everywhere that you can see and can't see, so you never know where 5G might really be. That's why you have to keep tuning in to PRN to get up-to-date news, findings, and research on 5G. You know, this is where you can hear it, right here at PRN.fm, the consciousness of the Progressive Enlightenment, the Progressive Radio Network. Where, oh where, can you find the mind, heart, and soul of the progressive consciousness? The Gary Null Show is where. It is America's number one ranked progressive radio program, and Gary Null is the most comprehensive voice of the progressive enlightenment. So you can hear it all right here. Weekdays, noon to 1 Eastern, 9 to 10 Pacific, on PRN.FM, the number one progressive station, the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, everybody. I am Karen Hartglass, the host of It's All About Food. Join me every Tuesday from 4 to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, or catch all of my shows in the archives. You can find my archive programs at the Progressive Radio Network website, or you can call my personal archive phone number to hear the most recent 5 episodes of It's All About Food. Here's the number: 1-701-719-0885. Here it is again: 1-701-719-0885. Learn about how we can solve many of the world's problems today and do it deliciously here on It's All About Food.
And welcome back. Thank you so much for joining us right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Get in touch at naturalnurse.com or Facebook The Natural Nurse. Go to naturalnurse.com to see classes and workshops that you can join in with or without needing CE credits for nurses and massage therapists, registered dietitians, and others. But if you're just interested, you absolutely can just go ahead and join us for the class. And today, our guest is Dr. Kenneth Redcross. We have a few more minutes before we'll be wrapping up. And Dr. Redcross has been so good to inform us about a lot of information about our COVID-19 situation. Tell us the best ways for people to find out about you and more information, Dr. Redcross.
Oh, sure. So my website is drkenredcross.com. You guys can reach out to me on all the social media platforms, which is Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn. It's Ken Redcross, MD, and I really mean it. Please reach out. I love answering questions and being helpful in any way that I can.
And then you shared with us stuff that's really great information for anyone about being sure to use vitamin D.
Yeah.
Is there a kind of vitamin D, if you're going to supplement, that you find better than others?
Yeah, that's why it's important to do two things. So as we talk a lot about vitamin D today, everyone, I will say, look, it's important to make sure that we check our levels and we know what they are. But vitamin D is not a treatment for the coronavirus. That's not what we're talking about today.
Okay, important. Good.
Yeah, very important, because we just know that vitamin D is incredibly important for the immune system. And so if any of those disease states that we talked about are active in you or your loved one, that's why it's important to take this kind of vitamin D challenge going forward for everyone.
So that's an important one. But you know, there's so many on the market. I'm not saying a brand, but is there a form?
No, I apologize, everyone. I'm sorry, Ellen. I forgot that part of your question, because
that's okay.
You're right. So there's vitamin D2, everyone, and vitamin D3. D3 is the one that you take every day as part of your staple. D2 we usually use in the medical office when a person comes in and they are profoundly low. And we use that at 50,000 units each and every week, usually for 4 to 6 weeks, depending on how low. And we use that, Ellen, to bring it up. But D3 is the one that you'll get over the counter, everyone. There's a lot of good brands out there. I tend to like the ones that are at the Whole Foods or Sprouts or Mrs. Greens, that sort of thing, because you know they're usually a whole ingredients, because it's very difficult to get vitamin D out of our diets, everyone. Everyone will mention milk, but don't forget, milk is fortified, meaning that vitamin D is added. So that's why it's important to make sure that we're supplementing with vitamin D each and every day. But D3 is the one that we want to go with here.
Right. That's great. Sharing that information, Dr. Ken Redcross, I'm so happy that you were able to join us today. One thing I talk about, too, is if you were going to use any supplement, is read your labels.
Yeah.
Because with vitamin D, the one I use, and we're not going to mention brand names here, but people can email if they'd like to know. But when you read the back of that label, it says D3, as Dr. Redcross suggested, and then the other ingredients say extra virgin olive oil, period. And it's just a liquid that you drop right in your mouth. So with some of them, you could buy a bottle of it and it'll say on the back, red dye number 14, and,
right.
You know,
right.
Sugar and all kinds of coloring agents, and yet it will be D3. So reading those ingredients, just like it's important to read ingredients on food, on supplements also counts.
No, you're right there. And you know, and we mentioned that website earlier, thepowerofd.org. Look at it, everyone. There's a lot of good information to learn and really understand even more about what vitamin D is able to do and how you can figure out a way to get it into your diet the best way you can as well.
That's so true. Well, you have had just an absolute plethora of information, Dr. Redcross. And as we get towards the end of our show today, what are just some little gems of wisdom you'd like to leave with our guests?
Yeah, I'd say everyone, look, let's all do our best to hang in there together, because I'm right there with you. I have kids as well, and we're all trying to figure out what's going on with schools, or we have older loved ones, and we're trying to figure out how to protect them and ourselves. But, you know, I will always say the most important thing is that we all do this together with love and happiness as a group, as a family, and make sure that we're following those three adages that we talked about, right? Whether it's masks, social distancing, and making sure we're washing our hands, especially with flu season coming as well. So let's band together, because together is the best way to kind of lead this fight.
And if we added anything to that, it might be eat healthy.
Oh, yes.
To the best of your ability. And drink water, let's say, instead of soda.
There you go.
You don't need more money to do that. You can
you
eat
not.
Healthy just eating cabbage and rice instead of takeout food.
Oh, yes. That's another show in and of itself right there, Ellen. Takeout and that sort of thing.
Well, thank you so much for being our guest today, Dr. Kenneth Redcross. You can find him at drkenredcross.com and all the social media outlets. And for Natural Alternatives, this is your host, Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, as well as for my co-host, Dr. Eugene Zamperone. Until next time, we're hoping that you stay healthy.